Hello guys, I'm Virginia Antiva and you're with the Fashion Photography Podcast. This is our first episode that, in fact, we have not just one, but two guests. I'm so excited to start this conversation because today we're going to talk about creative process and fixing things in post. Also about the high contrast and the fashion editorials for magazines. Say hello to my two guests.
Hi, this is Chris Nichols. I'm a fashion photographer in Toronto, Canada, and I've been shooting for many years, and I shoot fashion and celebrities and beauty, some advertising, and I'm here with my wife.
My name is Lorca Moore, and I am a retoucher, so I do beauty retouching and color work primarily for fashion and beauty clients.
I was wondering if you've been working your jobs before you met.
Yes, I was a photographer. I'm a little bit older than Lorca, and she was a model. Oh. And so I did an editorial shoot with her when she was pretty young. And then I didn't work with her for about 3 years. And then at the last minute, really, she was recommended for a 2-week editorial shoot in the south of France for a bridal magazine. So we spent 2 weeks together in the south of France, and we fell in love.
The rest is history. And that was 22 years ago.
Whoa, long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the irony is that I actually, I almost didn't go on the shoot because for editorial, for magazines, it typically doesn't pay particularly well. But, you know, you do it for the opportunity to be in some beautiful creative photographs. And I wasn't sure if a bridal editorial was really a good use of time. But boy, was I wrong. So luckily, my agent, who I've been with for... I guess 26 years now. She told me that there was something very special about this photographer, about Chris, and she just had a feeling that we were going to hit it off. I think mostly because we were both pretty shy. I don't think even she realized how good her intuition was on that.
She wasn't matchmaking.
No, not at all. It was just a matter of you know, wanting me to be comfortable because she'd know me since I was so young. And so it was a testament to Chris. And, you know, he was considered sort of an up-and-coming photographer at the time. And all the stories we shot ended up being quite beautiful. And in fact, Chris has won quite a few awards in fashion categories, specifically for bridal editorials, which is very unusual, as you can imagine. It was a defining experience, that's for sure.
Definitely. Did you invite the agent on the wedding?
We did, actually.
Oh, great.
We're in Halifax, Nova Scotia, which is a little bit remote. It's where I'm from, where I grew up. Yeah, we were very touched. Almost everyone that we invited, either from Toronto or internationally, actually made the trip. Yeah, that was really special. That was 18 years ago.
Chris, I was wondering, what did you do before you met her? Did you retouch all of your photos by yourself?
So back in those days, it was film, of course.
Yeah.
I was a pretty good retoucher, but in those days, the retouching was really very primitive. You were really painting on the photographs, or I did a hand coloring. You know, as I started out as an assistant for other photographers, I also printed for them. And so I was pretty handy in the darkroom doing all that sort of thing. And really the post-production end digitally has replaced what all the experimentation that took place in the darkroom previously. But I was very glad to get out of the darkroom and focus on, you know, doing the photography.
Lorca, was Chris your inspiration to become a retoucher?
Actually, my inspiration was a very talented makeup artist from Montreal named Isabelle Lepage, who she had a very unique style of doing makeup. She would only use her hands and her fingers instead of the typical brushes. And she would make her own pigments and creams. And it was at a time back in starting around the turn of the century. Yeah, the late 90s, early 2000s, where shine on skin really became sort of a part of, you know, it became sort of a movement in fashion and beauty. And it's something that previously was somewhat unusual. You know, the makeup used to be very matte in the 80s and 90s. Things would be blown out so that you wouldn't have to deal with skin texture. She kind of came along right at a time when seeing more skin and seeing shine became a thing. And so she, just as a natural extension of that, she started experimenting with Photoshop just to sort of further her vision. And I was just so blown away by what she was doing, because it was very subtle. But it just sort of elevated every photograph in a way that you almost couldn't put your finger on what it was. But suddenly every model looked like a supermodel. Every shoot looked like an international caliber story. And so I just sort of had to figure out what she was doing. And luckily she did work a fair bit with Chris at that time around 2000, mm-hmm. 2001, 2002. And I got to talk to her about it and sort of figure out what she was doing. And Chris was also able to, this was before he switched to digital, but by that time things were being scanned and retouched more regularly. And he was able to sort of to bring her on board on many jobs and sort of pitch what she was doing to clients. I became so fascinated with what she was doing and I sort of took it from there.
I was wondering if you've ever worked with another photographer.
I have, actually. In the beginning, in particular, when I first started 13 years ago, I actually worked with more photographers as a retoucher in those days than I do now. Partly because retouching was a relatively new thing. There weren't very many people doing what I now refer to as beauty retouching. And so people were really open to it. And I feel like I was very lucky timing-wise that photographers and magazines in particular, even though there wasn't much of a budget for retouching, they were very open to sort of just giving me a couple days with the files. They would do the scans, you know, scan the film, mm-hmm. scan the negatives. They would send it to me. They would give me a couple days. And my pitch to them at the time was that if they, you know, to give me, you know, give me a bit of time with it. And then if they were happy with it, great, run with it. And if not, they could just sort of, you know, start from scratch. There's nothing lost. And so it actually was a pretty unique and wonderful time to learn, because people were so open. And there's still kind of a lack of people doing it, of specifically fashion and beauty, aesthetic retouching. But yeah, I worked with lots of great Canadian photographers. And then as the years have gone on, I have to admit that I've sort of narrowed my field down a little bit to focusing mainly on Chris's work. And there's sort of two reasons for that. One is just workflow. If you work with the same team all the time, there are just less hiccups along the way. I know I'm going to get excellent files from our digital tech on time, and he provides an excellent support system. And then I have my two assistants who work with me regularly, and there's sort of less variables, less unknowns. So that's one of the reasons. And then the other reason, which is more aesthetic, more philosophical, is that as my work evolved, I became very interested in the color calibration of the images, or the mm-hmm. sort of the treatment, the filtering, et cetera, which is sort of what Chris was referring to. You know, it's sort of the equivalent of what custom printing used to be. So that's sort of become my real passion. It goes so hand in hand with the signature look of the photographer. So it's, for me, it can be a bit complicated if I'm working on another photographer's work, because, you know, on the one hand, I don't want to kind of step on their toes creatively. I feel like they should be able to define the look of their images in terms of the color and filtration. And on the other hand, if I'm specifically asked to kind of run with it in that direction, I do feel a bit of an internal conflict. I don't necessarily want to make any other photographer's work look exactly like Chris's work, because, like I said, that is such an individual signature thing. So that does sort of raise some questions for me. And I think in most cases, photographers do handle most of their own color work and love doing it for the most part. So I feel like it's maybe a bit of a unique relationship that we have, where Chris gives me a lot of freedom in the color department that maybe is not typical of a photographer retoucher relationship. So it has just sort of organically evolved into a situation where I would say probably 90% of my work is specifically for Chris. But I do deal with a lot of clients directly. And so sometimes those clients will contact me and bring me on board for an unrelated project. And, you know, depending what it is, I don't mind doing that.
It seems like you're very inspired by each other.
Yeah.
Or we're just stuck with each other.
Stuck with each other, making the best of it.
It's a choice.
Yeah, I mean, I think the timing was good for me to sort of make that transition. I certainly never anticipated that it would turn into a career. It was just more of the novelty of it. And I was still modeling pretty much full time at the time. So I kind of thought, oh, maybe I could use some of these little tricks that I've learned to, you know, to fix up some shots of mine. Because oftentimes there'll be a photograph that you love, but there's just one thing that stands out that's not quite right. Like, oh, only that strange shadow wasn't there, or, you know. If only the makeup wasn't smudged in that one corner. So I guess I really did think I would just use it sort of for my own personal use. So it's interesting how very surprising things can kind of fall in your lap. And then I guess it's just whether or not you choose to run with it.
Yeah, I do believe the same thing, by the way. Well, Chris, it's a question for both of you. Maybe we should start with Chris. Tell me more about your creative process.
That's a very hard thing to define. I mean, I think the way we usually work with other creative people, art directors, magazines and such, is that there's an idea brought to the table initially. You know, let's say it's Baroque clothing with a modern twist or something like that. And then what I prefer at that point in time is just to be kind of left with that idea. And then to just kind of mull it over in my head. Very often I'll do a little bit of research online to see, like, to define exactly what that is, or to look at the clothing references. And then beyond that, it's like an internal process of, I mean, you have to be careful in photography not to copy other people.
Yeah.
I find that that's a bit of a, you know, a lot of people do rely on that. They're like, oh, you know, what do you think of this editorial? You know, be like, oh, it's great. It's awesome. And we'll go, yeah, let's do something like that. And my reaction is, yeah, let's do something that feels like that sort of inspiration, but I don't want to do that. You know, let's make sure that no one looks at our shoot and goes, they obviously saw that shoot in Vogue or whatever, and they just copied it. At the same time, I mean, I think if enough time goes by, you know, you can be inspired by photographers' work from days gone by, but I think it's a mistake to be inspired by or to copy work that's coming out internationally recently, I guess.
Yeah, I believe those are two different things, being inspired of something, copying something.
But it's hard to know where ideas come from. I mean, I used that example earlier, the Baroque and the modern, just because that's a specific example I do use to explain a particular shoot that I did do for Flair magazine, where what came to mind was a Stanley Kubrick reference from 2001, Space Odyssey, where there's this wonderful scene at the end of the movie where this astronaut walks into this room and the floor is glowing, but the walls are very Baroque or old-fashioned. So there's this weird mix of modern and new and even then, when I took that idea back to the magazine, they were like, oh, yeah, let's do that. And I'm like, OK, well, let's do something like that. But let's make sure no one looks at that and goes, oh, you took that exact idea and you just copied it. Then it evolves from there. So, I mean, I certainly think that, you know, most creativity evolves from other ideas and other inspiration by the, you know, the quality of the people that you steal from. It's been said. You kind of try and free up your mind and think, what would be great? Like, what would be great? What would you expect to see when you open a magazine? If someone told you there's this amazing shoot that was done in the mountains, before you open the magazine and someone's already told you that, what are you expecting to see? How great is it? Like, you know, you want to see something that you've never seen before.
Or sometimes it's what you're not expecting to see.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, no, you need to be surprised. You need to think, like, actually use that as a bit of a tool. If someone were to explain something that you haven't seen yet, but that then they're saying it's so good, you've never seen anything like this before, your mind races to try and fill the gap, really, to say, what is that? Like, what is that thing you've never seen before? You're like, okay, well, maybe it's colored gels, or it's, you know, she's lit in a very strange way, or, oh, it's that kind of compositional, that weird composition that's so special and not predictable. Or so, I mean, that's part of the creative process, but it's an interesting subject, the creative process and where ideas come from.
Do you usually discuss your ideas with Lorca?
No.
No, Lorca, how do you feel about that?
Really doesn't. That makes total sense to me. It's very natural because it's a different part of the process. And I almost don't like to, I mean, I don't mind hearing Chris's thoughts or inspiration before doing a shoot, but I really don't like to see outtakes right after they've shot it. If I know it's usually 2 or 3 weeks before the selects are made and the files actually come back to me. I actually don't like to see it unless there's a very specific issue or question about how to process the files or something, because I feel like I want to look at it with fresh eyes and I want to have sort of like forgotten in the short term what was discussed about it. Or I'll hear stories about a little bit of tension on set, like, oh, the art director wasn't so happy with this, or
so,
you know.
You're not on the set?
No, I'm not on the set. Mm-hmm. No. So, because I'm always working, you know, anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks behind. So whatever they've finished shooting a couple of weeks earlier is sort of fresh on my plate. And I don't know, I once heard Celine Dion say that she didn't like to practice the song hardly at all before making the first attempt at recording. And that kind of makes sense to me. I mean, if there's anything, you know, that I need to be made aware of, like, you know, there's very specific expectation from the client. Oh, it has to be, it has to be filtered very cool and crisp or something like that. That's important to know. But beyond that, I just feel like I want to look at it with fresh eyes. And often I have no idea what the final calibration is going to be until I actually start playing with it. I'm sure there are other people who work differently. I know there are some very renowned photographers who have a whole team of retouchers on set with them. And that's something that we have discussed here to figure out if that could work. And I think the advantage there is that creative process can sort of occur all at once, that maybe there's sort of a spark in the air when it's happening and people can have input, and you know, you can try it this way, try it that way, and then maybe that affects how you actually set up the next shot, like what's working and what isn't. And I certainly wouldn't be opposed to doing that for certain shoots, or having another team of retouchers who could be on set. But for me personally, I kind of like the hermit-like existence. It's almost like being a writer. I think there's something about being sort of cloistered in my garret. It can be very lonely, but I feel like it's much more conducive to my particular process. If a lot of people want to have a lot of input at that stage when I'm actually working on the color, I find that can sort of water things down, because as soon as you start being conscious, you know, of the steps, and if people say, well, don't do this, but, you know, do that, or I want less of this and more of that, suddenly it becomes more like a mathematical equation and you're sort of retouching by committee, which for creative work, I don't think that's going to give you the best result. I'm sure other people work differently, and that dynamic isn't ideal for every client, but for the most part, people just sort of leave me alone. And often I'll provide variations. If there are a couple of different directions that seem exciting to me, I'll often provide sort of a safer version. And then, you know, a really experimental version. And then it's sort of up to the client or the magazine to run with it either way. And generally, I don't think I take it personally. I mean, I know there's a lot of different interests that have to be weighed. And, you know, maybe one particular version does just simply show the clothes better. I always think it's important to remember that when it comes to fashion, we celebrate the fantasy and the creativity of it. Ultimately, the hero is the fashion. People don't see it the way that I do, but usually it works quite well, I have to say. Between Chris and then the clients that we work with regularly, I think I'm very lucky that they do give me a lot of freedom. And then having said that, there are other times where I do almost nothing to impact the end result. You know, Chris will have a really strong idea out of the gate, and they'll process the files with a very extreme treatment and it looks amazing. And so there are times when I just basically leave it alone. It's sort of mine to ruin. It's a balance.
Have you ever had a disagreement about the final look of a photo?
I mean, we have, but...
Yes. You're laughing. I heard you.
I mean, I just more about the process, I guess.
It's rare, to be fair. It's rare.
I'll talk to you about that later on.
You might want to separate us. I mean, I guess the reason why I'm laughing is because there's a bit of history there, which is that when I first started learning how to retouch, and I say this with love, that Chris wasn't sure if that was the best idea, because I think he was concerned that could be sort of a loaded proposition, that there was potential for a lot of disagreement. And I think above all, his concern is that I just wouldn't be very good at it. And then that would sort of put him in an awkward position, mm-hmm. you know. To be like, oh, well, I have a retoucher, but she's not very good. So, but having said that, luckily I ignored all of his concerns. And he did, you know, very heroically did sort of leap in immediately when I really got started and got me all set up with the best and most modern equipment and was happy to trust me early on to have a go at it. But I would say it's rare. And I would say when we disagree on the end result, ultimately he should veto me because it's his work, his name is on it. My name's never on it.
I'm glad you're recording this, by the way.
But having said that, a handful of times when we've disagreed, there are specific times when he has yielded to me or when the art director has felt strongly that it was sort of worth considering my take on it. And sometimes that has turned out to be the right decision. But I don't know, there, back to that fresh eyes thing. It's like, if I've been sitting with it for, you know, 2 days on one story, you lose your objectivity so quickly. So it is actually very helpful. I always hand the story back over to Chris at the end and to Branko, our digital tech. And then they have a bit of time with it before they deliver it. So there are things that my eyes have lost their objectivity by that point. So if anything, it's a comfort to me that I know there'll be one more stage of evaluation before it goes out the door, because then they'll catch something. If it just overall doesn't quite feel right in terms of color, they of course have the freedom at that point to
completely change it.
But yeah. But that's rare.
I mean, I think the creative process, again, back to that idea, it's very collaborative for me, but there's like stages of autonomy. There's stages of decision making, which mm-hmm. is just my decision. And there's stages where the stylist says, no, these are the clothes we're shooting. You might not like this dress, but this is an important dress. It's yeah. important we shoot this right now on this girl in this setting. This is the right decision. And I think that there is a democracy that happens, you know, and then we're working with very creative people, and creative people tend to be, they're a difficult bunch. They're an arty bunch. I don't know. I like that process. And I do believe, and certainly have learned more so over time, that empowering people with the responsibilities to make it right is the best. I mean, just thinking about the results that art directors get from me when they say, you've got 8 pages in the magazine, what do you want to do? Just make it brilliant, you know, like make it like amazing. This has to be so good. I'm not putting any restrictions on you. Mm-hmm. You know, then you really rise up and you go, okay, it's completely for mine to ruin here. But if an art director goes, okay, here are the rules. It's a gray background. I don't want to mess with the color. These are the clothes. You just start like, all right, I'll do it. I'm going to do it. But you've already sort of resigned yourself to the fact probably won't be that good. I've lost control of it. And so when it comes to dealing with Lorca on set, very often we have like very distinct ideas about the way it's going. And, you know, it's interesting to be on set and to see the way it's like, we've all done it so many times, but every time it is fresh and there's a bit of a shock when you suddenly realize how bad it could be if everyone doesn't rise to the challenge appropriately. I'm very critical of my own work and usually deeply unsatisfied when I finish a project and then hand it over to Lorca. And I need her eyes to say, I know nothing about this job. I'm seeing it for the first time. It's really good. I know what I'm going to do with this. Or sometimes she'll say, you know what? You guys shot it on a brown background. I'm just going to change that to gray. You're going to see it's going to be way better. Mm-hmm. And when the ship is already moving, or the train or whatever is already moving at full speed in one direction, sometimes it's hard to turn it around or to stop it. But very often it is those fresh eyes. And I might go, whoa, 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 no, no, no. It's, you know, it's a brown background. Or if in the very beginning we started the shoot, it was a brown background shoot. That's what we all said we were doing.
Yeah.
And Orca will say, yeah, but look at this. And then sometimes she's so right.
Your second pair of eyes.
A second prize. Sometimes it's wrong. Now go, you know what? Okay, appreciate your opinion, but we are going to proceed with this problem.
But I'd say that rarely ends up in a fist fight.
I was wondering if you have ever said to yourself, I'm going to fix it on post.
I mean, actually, our digital tech, Branko, has a t-shirt that he wears commonly, or on set a lot, that says in huge letters, fix it on set.
Good job.
And I don't know if he chooses the days that he wears that for certain art directors. There's a lot of very time-consuming things that are, it does make sense to fix in post.
Or things that are only possible in post.
Yeah.
Like some sort of like hyper-realism. But Photoshop does sort of open a whole world of opportunity if it's used tastefully. So there are things that we all agree going in will be achieved. I'm a little wary of the word fix or correct. I feel like that refers more to like color correcting a shoe because we could only get it in brown and we're actually buying it in black, or, you know, whatever the case may be. So that's sort of an old school way of thinking about retouching. But I'd say most of what we do is more sort of elevating, transforming, filtering, stuff that you really do want to do in post. But I have issues with stylists sometimes who get lazy and don't press don't press a silk gown. Because the problem with that is not just the time that would be involved. That's a good use of the word fix, to fix it. But just the fact that it will never look as good. It will always look a little bit fake. So a retoucher is constantly struggling with the fact that things slip over that edge into looking fake or cyber or airbrushed. And you always want to avoid that. So where I have issues with stuff that could have been achieved on set is where it sort of puts me in a difficult position. For men's suiting, for example, it's almost impossible to recreate the texture and the stitching, and it just will never look real. So, and that to me will distract from the ideal end result. So that's the only time I would have an issue.
Yeah, the retouching, the color work and everything is part of what should be a straight line process from what you envision it to be to how you shoot it on set to what you do with it afterwards. It's all like pre-envisioned that as to where you're going, where you intend to go with it.
Well, it's still important to be open to sort of creative surprises.
No, I think so too.
But yeah, you don't want to get bogged down by details that aren't necessary.
It's a criticism of a lot of perhaps unfair, a newer generation. And, you know, I'm older. So and maybe people say this to me only because they think I want to hear it. So there you go. But when I was younger, we shot film and we had no retouching. So you would have to literally fix it on set, literally no retouching on the final product. So every little clamp showed or pin or a button or the makeup or the hair, there was no fixing it later. So we do tend to still think that way on set. Whereas a lot of younger photographers, the criticism I hear of a lot of younger photographers is they're like, don't worry, it looks like shit now, but it's going to look great when I'm done with it. You know? And so on set, clients are not reassured by that. Clients like to see something on the monitor on set that they can fall in love with, that they can take home with them, that they can screen cap or take a picture with their phone and go, oh yeah, we got it. That was looks so beautiful on set. It doesn't even need retouching. There are a lot of people that do lean very heavily on the post-production process. But having said that, that's just a different way of working. And they get a different kind of result. And sometimes they get something really interesting working that way. So it's just a different process.
You don't want anything to be a crutch. You want everything to be a tool.
There you go.
True. Yeah. I love that answer. But like I said, I have a really favorite photo shoot of yours. And like work said, there are some things that you can do only in post. And this photo shoot is one of these examples.
I hope it's one I actually worked on.
I really hope it's one that you actually worked on, because this is really my favorite photo shoot of yours. And I saw it a few years ago. It just stayed in my head like forever. And when I started with the podcast, I found you, Chris, and I didn't know that this photo shoot is yours. And once I saw it, I was so determined that I have to find you, because some people are very hard to reach. Fortunately, you're not one of them. And I really have so many questions about it. So Lorca, helping.
What is it? Well, you got us in suspense.
Okay. So it's a photo shoot in black and white, and there are some reverse parts with negatives and positives, you know.
Is it very graphic?
Very graphic.
Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I actually did not work on that story, just for scheduling reasons. But I think there are some really interesting things going on in that story. And I'm happy to tell you that the person who did the post on that was actually Chris. So it's one of the few times when he's actually taken on the post-production part of the job himself. There's a beauty picture from that story in particular, where everything around the girl's face is negative. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing that for the first time and thinking, there's something about, and perhaps it's what you're responding to as well, there's something about the perspective of the photographer himself coming from the background, all those years in the darkroom, et cetera, that kind of, it gave him like a little window into interesting things that could be done in a way that probably would not have occurred to me. So I actually agree with you that there are some shots from that story that are quite inspiring.
We are talking about the same story, right?
The one for fashion, yeah.
With the close-up of the girl with the square over her face?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. All right.
Yeah, that was actually nominated for a magazine award here.
That was Isabel that retouched that, wasn't it?
No, but she's talking about the effects.
Oh, the effects.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, so we...
About the effects.
So So yeah, there was another beauty retoucher on that job who took care of the beauty, and then Chris did all the post effects on that. And there's some red elements as well in that story.
Yeah, just trying to take the graphicness of it one step further beyond the set, beyond the clothes, but into the kind of next dimension. It was just a good opportunity to do that.
And they were, you know, with this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Don't step with just good opportunity. Tell me about the story behind the photo shoot.
Well, the stylist came with an idea. I mean, I would say that I would give the credit to the stylist for the idea. There were a lot of graphics contrasting.
What was the story
black
called?
And white.
Was it called High Contrast?
High Contrast, or something maybe? Like that?
It was for Fashion Magazine, if anyone wants to try and find it. But
yeah, I'm not showing it for you because I'm sure many people have seen it. And I wanted to just remind them how it looks because it's just an audio. Yeah.
The stylist brought the idea of high contrast. Then I had a discussion with her that we should get a set builder in to construct some sets that are really graphic. We got some, got like a seat made, and we got some walls made of the stripes. And then the posing was very graphic. Yeah. And it was all, you know, it's all shot in one day. The model's wearing a wig.
Yeah,
I seem to remember there were some issues with the wig. And I think the original idea, if I recall you discussing it, was that you'd hoped that the graphic set would translate better. And after it was shot, that's when the idea occurred to you of trying to do some graphic elements in post just to sort of elevate at that point. And I think that did sort of come about a little bit organically.
That was what I was wondering about.
Yeah.
Okay, no, because we shot some of them on a white background with the intention of adding, there's one with circles on it.
Yeah.
She's standing very graphically, and that's one of my favorite shots, and it has the circles overlapping her. And just the negative positive, playing with the negatives selectively, it was something that I was interested in doing. And, you know, I probably spent a day just with the final files, just providing, you know, we did multiple variations on them where we changed the color, changed the negative, moved the graphics around. And so I think in the end, I probably presented the magazine with two or three options per shot of the ones that have the graphics over them. And I was particularly happy with that one close up. And I think that idea came to me quite quickly. You know, I think it was probably the first thing I did. It was just a matter of where that square was going to sit.
Yeah. I actually love it when someone else handles the post, or if Chris, a few times that he's sort of experimented with effects, I actually kind of like it when I'm not involved once in a while, because I feel like it brings a new energy. You don't want all the work to start looking the same. And I guess I do sort of rely on certain approaches. So I remember in that case in particular, thinking that the story was much better for the fact that I wasn't involved, because it just sort of, Chris did just sort of sit down with it and say, oh, I'm just going to experiment. I'm just going to try some things that I wouldn't normally have a chance to do. And so it's interesting that you picked up on that story.
You have your own style and it's very recognizable, I believe. But do you think that you somehow influence one another's style?
Yeah, I mean, we have sort of a general agreement on, we very often look at pictures together and go, oh my God, that's so good. Or usually that's so bad. Let's never do something that looks like that. Please stop me if I ever do.
And we usually agree. We were actually just looking last night at, I won't name the show in particular, but we were looking at the posters for a very popular American series that's in its seventh season. And so they've done a different sort of key image for each season. And every single one is terrible. I was suddenly struck by that. So we kind of just quickly went through it together on the iTunes screen. And it was interesting that we actually did sort of pick up on almost exactly the same elements in every case of why it was just so wrong.
It's sort of a common joke in the industry when something's particularly bad, like let's say the makeup is just horrendous on something, that there's some very accomplished makeup artist that I'll be working with. And I'll be like, hey, Tony, I saw that makeup you did on that editorial. And he's like, oh, which one? You know, and then I pull it out. And of course, it's a joke that it's so bad. But then so he'll counter with, oh, I liked your photographs for the so-and-so. And I'll look at it and I'll just be horrendous. Photographers look at light. Stylists look at clothes. Makeup artists look at makeup. Like a hairstylist looking at a photograph, it could be a great photograph, but if the hair is not that good or not that interesting, they'll just go, that's not a good photograph. I'll look at just the photography. Like I can admire amazing lighting, Now, a stylist might look at it and go, yeah, but what's she wearing? That's garbage. Or Lorca will look at it and go, the skin's over retouched. And I don't see that.
No one else cares.
I don't see that. I just see a great photograph and I don't care. That's a skin technique. That's a skin technique. It's not my skin technique. It's not what we mostly do. But in this case, it's fine. It doesn't matter. It's different.
There's one thing I can think of that I sort of tried to nudge Chris in a particular direction early on, which again is sort of just self-serving as a retoucher, but I wanted to see more skin. I think Chris's style, you know, 15 years ago was perhaps a bit more romantic and less sexy, more classical, mm-hmm. in a sense. I have to give some credit actually to other photographers who sort of turned me on to certain international photographers' work or ways of thinking aesthetic. Yeah, I do remember at one point coming to you and saying, I want to see more skin. But these girls are always all loaded up with all these layers and layers of clothing or like flowing gowns. And just because I wanted to have the chance to experiment a bit more with that and also to light the skin in such a way that you can really see the skin. I don't mind seeing all the flaws because I know that those can be sort of toned down, but I really want to see skin texture. I want to see skin that is touchable, that's dewy, that you feel like you could almost reach out and touch it. So, I mean, I think that was a natural evolution of the industry as a whole at that time. But I do remember that we had that discussion numerous times.
But I think every artist wants to highlight, you know, you talk to the makeup artist, whether the shot looks better mm-hmm. full length or close up, and they'll always go, close up. It looks good close up because they want to see their makeup. It makes sense. The retoucher wants to see the skin. You want to see what... You know, this is your craft. This is what you do.
No, I fully acknowledge
that. Whereas a photographer, I think like a person could be really far away or they could be really close up and you're just looking for, but you're also still looking for like, oh, look how, you know, like,
how
good your lighting is or how well composed it is. Yeah. It could be well composed with lousy skin texture and bad clothes. But it's like, wow, look at that composition. Really, it's lit so well.
Do you think that your work has shifted over like the last 10 years or so in a way? Like, is it any different because I've been involved or?
Yeah, I think my work's a lot better working with you. I think I have been doing this for a very long time and it would be very easy to just kind of coast out. But I do think that we're doing better and better work. I'd say in the last 10 years, I've done much better photography than any other mm-hmm. time in my career, you know, when I was younger. Mm-hmm. So,
but it's hard to know why that is.
Well, no, I mean, I think the collaboration, what you've brought at that end, I think is just everyone trying to raise the bar as well. I mean, I agree with you about the skin tone. I tend to like a lot of different things.
You're so sweet. How many people do you have in your crew?
So I have my studio manager, Clive Chow. He started out with me as a black and white printer, and we've worked together for over 20 years. Branko Karan, and he is from Bulgaria.
Oh,
and Clive's from Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm. And you're from England.
I'm from England.
So. I like to say I'm the only Canadian studio.
We're all a bunch of immigrants. So Branko came on board. He started doing freelance digital work. Digital teching for us just about 10 years ago. I think 10 years. So he's been here full time for 10 years.
It might be more than 10.
It might be a little bit more. Yeah. So the core is Lorca and I and Branko and Clive. Then we have regular assistants that we work with until they become proficient photographers and go out the door. Lorca works with two mm-hmm. assistants as well.
I have my first assistant who's been with me for, say, about 7 years now, Patty Watain. And then I have other people that I use from time to time, depending on the nature of the job. And in the last year or two, have found a wonderful second assistant who sort of fills those gaps.
Have you been teaching them?
Retouching-wise? No, actually, it's quite different from the photographer-photo assistant relationship where they really do come to work in the studio and learn from Chris, learn about lighting, and then get to know the clients. In my case, because I'm self-taught and not particularly technical, I actually need people who can do a lot of the things that I can't do or don't know how to do. To be fair, sometimes it's just stuff that's sort of time consuming and tedious, and they're very diligent and they never complain. But yeah, no, I actually need people who have a broad skill set that I don't have. Sort of the evolution of that relationship is I can sort of nudge them in a certain direction. Like let's say with the, you know, the skin, for example, on the body, which my main assistant does most of the cleanup on the bodies. I sort of know, I know what I want the end result to be, but I don't necessarily know the best or the most efficient techniques to get there. So she's free to do that however she likes, using whatever techniques and constantly kind of improving and researching. So I can sort of say where I want it to end up, but then it's up to her to decide how to get there. So I would say that, you know, probably my main assistant's approach has probably evolved over the years, just from me kind of saying what I feel works and doesn't work. But in terms of just pure Photoshop skill, she's is miles ahead of me. And I'm actually hesitant. I have had a lot of junior retouchers and students come through and ask me if they just want to know the secrets. They just want to know, how do you do skin and how do you do this and what grain do you use? And I'm sort of hesitant to, and not because I feel like it's proprietary in particular. It's more just because I feel like my sort of self-taught methods may not be the best way to do it. I mean, I have a good eye, but that's not to say that, you know, that I couldn't be doing it more efficiently. So I kind of feel like I don't want to cloud a new retoucher's kind of brain with techniques that might be actually sort of obsolete. And if anything, I resist change whenever it's time to upgrade the system with the new version of Photoshop. I always kind of put it off as long as possible. And Branko every few months reminds me that, you know, it's time to update your system. And I'm always like, no, don't change anything. I know where all my buttons are and all my presets. But I also recognize that whenever I do go through that, you know, every year or two when we do kind of upgrade things, there's a bit of a learning curve. Even something as simple as just having a keyboard shortcut for something that I was sort of oblivious to for years, it can really be revolutionary. Since Chris didn't actually have any Photoshop experience when I started learning, there are little things that he's picked up over the years from Branko that I've then learned from him, like the fact that you can adjust brush size on the keyboard. That's such a ridiculous basic thing that I'm sure everyone else knows, but it had just never occurred to me to even wonder. So I'm constantly, you know, using my mouse to go up and change. And one day I just noticed Chris doing it on the keyboard. I'm like, wait, what are you doing there? That goes to show I'm a bit of a dinosaur when it comes to some of that stuff. But yeah, it's ironic that I actually need assistants who are far more knowledgeable than I am. And so then they can handle the very technical things like clipping, for example. I could not even tell you how to make a clipping pad. I know really, really good, talented, reliable people who can do that sort of stuff.
How did you find your assistants?
Ironically, my main assistant, Patty, used to be a custom printer, and I believe black and white was her specialty as well, similar to Clive, ironically. She had quite a reputation in Toronto for being one of the best printers for many years, and she's also a photographer in her own rights. She came to us. I mean, I had tried lots of people had come to me recently, graduated students, junior photographers, etc., and I did try out a lot of people, but it just never quite worked. I always felt like I was investing more time into the relationship than I was getting out of it. But when Patty came to the table, she just, I don't know, it was just a really good fit. She just had the advantage and the luxury of having had so many years of experience, seeing some things more from a photographer's perspective, and just a really solid knowledge of Photoshop. And she just seems to have boundless energy to learn. She's always upgrading her skills and retraining and doing research, which is very admirable because I should be doing that as well. But I can't, if I'm not actually on a job, I will do everything in my power to avoid sitting down at a computer, which even includes like paying bills and checking email. I often go days, you know, in between jobs. I cannot wait to get out of that room and away from that screen sometimes. So I have to say, I have to give Patty some real credit for that, that she oftentimes be doing research online, or she'll take a very advanced course in a very specific skill, because she also works on her own as a retoucher as well. She has lots of clients where she's the key retoucher. So it's just necessary for her skill set to be broader. And I'm always very impressed with that. And I can really see it translating in the work. I mean, there are ways she has skin techniques now, like in particular for, you know, legs, for example. There's just just natural. Legs are kind of blotchy. That's just, you know, that's just the nature. You know, when you're standing as a model for hours and hours, you're outside in the freezing cold. She has techniques that I honestly don't even know how she's doing it anymore. I just look at it and I'm like, wow,
that's, I should have brought her.
Really impressive.
Let's start over, and I could just bring Patty.
I'll make sure to find her. No worries.
It's sort of complimentary in that sense, because obviously I have the luxury of doing the more, the more creative part of it. So I love to do the faces, and like I love to add shine and that sort of thing. And I'm really obsessed with the texture, and obviously the color then is the final part of it. But it is tremendously helpful to have someone who's very technically skilled and detail oriented, who can sort of do the first pass, because it just takes a lot of that pressure off of me. And it also means that I have to sit with each individual image for less time, which I think is very important to keep your objectivity, to keep your eyes fresh. If you spend too much time kind of fiddling with the details, by the time you get down to the more creative parts of it, or the aesthetic of the beauty, the face, you've lost your objectivity by that point. So it's definitely a real advantage that it kind of passes through one person first before it comes to me. Can kind of be fresh.
You're talking a lot about the texture. Can you define what you like about it and what you don't? Because I'm sure many young people are listening to us right now, and maybe they are a little bit, I don't know, confused.
Yeah, it obviously totally depends what type of photography you're working on. You know, if you have a lot of advertising clients, for example, the expectations would be quite different. But for fashion and beauty specifically, and perhaps this is why there are so few retouchers who sort of specialize, I feel like there's sort of a Photoshop 101 approach to skin, which for me does not work. And that sort of blurring, you know, sort of isolating like the entire figure, blurring, and then they're high passing or using noise or laying on very sort of rudimentary Photoshop grain, that is just wrong. And I think the reason for that is that your eye can tell, like when something's been blurred, so everything's been distorted, even if you're laying back on a certain degree or type of texture, your eye just intuitively knows that something's not right. And the biggest giveaway is areas where highlight goes into shadow. So if there's a natural indent, you know, like around the knee or in the shoulder, the collarbones, if you use blur as the way to clean up the skin, then you've lost the natural gradation between highlight and shadow on the skin. And I feel like your eye always knows that. It's sort of like when you see retouching on TV, smart filters, etc. When the person's moving or talking, you can kind of see the blur floating in front of their face, almost like a little ghost, like a little blurry blob. And it's usually under the eyes. So from one angle, they'll look normal and human. And then from the other angle where they've invested the cash, in the post-production, there's this strange, blurry, floating thing underneath the eyes. And I feel like that sort of blur then high pass technique, which is, you know, sanctioned most like universities, most training programs, they still kind of rely on that. And I feel like that's usually a mistake. There are very extreme cases. Let's say you're removing a crazy amount of arm hair or something like that, where you need to get a little deeper into those techniques. But whatever you can do to avoid blurring, and even low opacity clone stamp, I use very sparingly. And I would say the key there, any area that has been distorted, retouched, low opacity clone stamp, the key there is having really good custom grain filters where you can mimic the grain that actually existed in the photograph in the other areas. And if you can mimic that before you flatten it down, then that's at least half the battle. That's the only real sort of general advice I would have for anyone who really wants to sort of, you know, get into that fashion aesthetic. Just take away less in the beginning. I think it's surprising how much when you do get into the calibrating, the contrast, the density, the color, it's amazing how much falls away, even just pushing the contrast a little bit, because you're sort of almost, you're tweaking the density, you're tweaking the lighting almost at that point. So what I'm constantly reminding myself to do is just sort of retouch less and calibrate more, because if you overdo it in the beginning with the retouching aspect of it, then when you go to do your sort of color and density adjustments, you sort of realize that you've taken it too far. So it's good to sort of check yourself at every stage and say, like, only take out what's absolutely necessary. And then you can always fine tune the skin at the end once you've sort of achieved the look, the filtration that you want.
I must admit, we have to split this conversation in two, so you'll be able to hear the rest of it next Wednesday. I'm really excited for the second part because you have so much more to learn from it. So before the second part, don't forget about our Friday conversation. Here again, in the Fashion Photography Podcast.